Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 59. On this episode, we are talking about The Imitation Game. Fortunately, I have two awesome people who were also very excited to finally fit this into the schedule, Alan Hawkins and Laura Fissel. We talk about this movie that centers around the life, or at least a piece of the life, of Alan Turing. Alan Turing was a code breaker in World War II in Britain. He had a team that got together, and they were able to break the Enigma code that the Germans were using for all their military communication. This is a game changer, and one of the most fascinating pieces of it is that we did not know about this for a long time. It took nearly 50 years for this story, these facts, to become declassified. So it was even more shocking when you take that into account with what happened during his life and what led to his death, the secrets that he felt he had to keep, not only for the government, but personally. So we have plenty to talk about. The movie itself won an Oscar for Best Adapted Screenplay from the book Alan Turing, The Enigma. We get to talk about wearing masks, our identity, basic human dignity. We even have a couple thoughts about marriage. Whether you thought this movie was super Oscar-worthy or not, it definitely hits on a whole bunch of hot-button issues that we're still dealing with today. So, with that said, here it is, episode 59, The Imitation Game, and How We Pretend. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
That's part of my challenge with movie reviews is I don't think very critically of a movie like, Oh, the acting wasn't that great. I'm usually more of what was the experience I had to the movie, then how was it all done? I'm more apt to stay in the experience.
That's why you liked Interstellar.
That's why I liked Interstellar. Yeah.
I like Interstellar.
I liked him sitting at the bedside of his daughter.
Yeah.
And she says, whatever her name was, Anne.
Yeah. Anne Hathaway.
Yeah.
After Anne Hathaway.
It wasn't her name in the movie. Yeah. You're like,
oh.
Yeah. She's out there all by herself.
Well,
slowly aging over millions of seconds.
Well, so the irony is that, like, I'm the one that has, like, or I'm spearheading this podcast.
Oh, sure.
You know, and I think I do the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the reasons that I like doing this so much is because it forces me to stop being just a critic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, instead of being like, the acting was terrible, the cinematography was terrible, the directing was terrible, da, da, da. You know, you didn't, you know, hit your plot points, you know, you didn't, your arc didn't actually, you know, pay off, all this stuff. Instead of doing that, I have to actually stop and say, why were we telling this story?
Yeah.
What impact does it make? Which is great. What it's awesome to take Laura, because Laura, I think
she thinks
lots of times she does the opposite thing. We've rubbed off on each other, you know, because we're married. It's what we do. And take that how you will.
I was gonna say just rub on each other, but I'm not. This is being recorded, right?
But you know, so now she's like, that thing was terrible.
Yeah.
But then she's like, words, I guess that's a big Euro 6 thing.
Actually, I'm realizing with Imitation Game that I have actually gotten a little bit more critical than I was before. But,
of the movie?
Like in general, in general. But this was my number one movie on my top 10 last year. And we watched it last night, and I was like, you know what? I think I wouldn't put it there anymore. It was right in front of Calvary, and I think that Calvary, for me, is a richer experience than this movie. But I think it was the emotional experience that really got me with this film.
Yeah.
So, and I'm still, I mean, I still like it for that reason.
Yeah.
And many others, but.
Well, so the thing about this film is I wish we could have had the chance to podcast on this, you know, a couple months ago.
Yeah, it's fresh.
When it was still a little bit more fresh and more people had seen it.
Yeah.
And it was getting a little bit more notoriety because the Oscars had kind of come and you know, they'd put out everything. Imitation Game got nominated for a bunch of stuff.
Did it win anything? I can't remember.
I don't think it did.
It won something for writing, right?
Because the kid gave that screenplay. Speech.
Yeah.
Best adapted screenplay?
Something like that.
It probably was because it was adapted from
His book.
Book. Yeah.
Yeah.
But no, I remember it was nominated for like music and, you know, acting, rightfully so. Anything that Benedict Cumberbatch probably acts in during the year, he should probably be nominated for something, you know, 9 times out of 10, and he was. So, yeah, like I said, there was more notoriety about it. There's more out there about it. But just like everything, sometimes we have time to do things, sometimes we don't. Either way, this movie was one of the movies last year that I thought kind of needed to be talked about, or gave us so much that it wouldn't be a crime not to talk about it compared to some of the things that, like, really, like Calvary. I felt like we had to talk about Calvary, even though it was a really small film. We had to talk about Calvary. But this I think is
adapted screenplay.
Adapted screenplay. Yep. See, internet. Thank you.
I don't necessarily agree with that. I think this offers a really important conversation, a kind of a new take on a conversation that's happening a lot right now.
Well, no, I do. That's what I'm saying. Like, I don't think it's quite to Calvary, but I think it's pretty. Okay. I think it's still pretty important. I just don't want to, you know. Anyway,
well, you can't like hold it up to caviar.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably nuancing it too much. Yeah. So, but with that said, I mean, like, it's like a historical piece. It's a social piece. And not only is it like a social piece in one way, but it's a social piece in two or three ways.
Mm-hmm.
So it does give us plenty to talk about. And I think that's why people are having like an emotional reaction to it. Like, people really like the movie, even though lots of critics had a number of things negative to say about either kind of how it was directed or how the story kind of unfolded. Things like that.
Slow in the middle.
Yeah, which is weird because it won Best Adapted Screenplay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if you write a really good screenplay, those kind of things shouldn't be the thing that you should be complaining about acting or something else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, because so like I said, this is historical. It's also like I said, social, because it deals with World War II and Alan Turing, who basically was doing something that no one would find out about until 50 years later.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've just recently actually kind of unearthed this story because everything was top secret for so long. So it's pretty amazing that this has kind of been, you know, swept under the rug. And, you know, I'm really surprised that people kind of kept it so hush for so long because it's such a big deal. It wasn't just a little thing. I mean, it's not Roswell, but it was definitely world-changing.
Well, have you seen the previews for Ex Machina?
Mm-hmm.
Or Ex Machina?
Machina, is that how
it is? I'm going to say Machina, because it sounds like...
Sounds
more highbrow.
You see what I'm saying? Like, if you're doing a sci-fi movie, would you call it
Machina?
You probably... Machina.
Well,
Machina.
Is that Latin? Is that Latin? Ex Machina?
Let's say, yeah. That sounds good, right?
Does it sound like Latin?
Well, it sounds like...
Latin or Greek.
I'm saying,
out of the machine.
Yeah, because I'm saying, like, you know, the deus ex machina of the play. Like, the thing that comes in and...
Right.
Yeah.
So, the story...
No, you're fine.
The story of that is to a guy who's creating artificial intelligence or wanting to see it happen. Brings in a guy to a remote location, Secret Isle, to have him do the Turing test.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, to see if he did, yeah.
Which is his enduring legacy of artificial intelligence.
Yeah, we really want to see Ex Machina. But like most movies that look really interesting, we have to wait for like an extra month for them to come anywhere near here.
Right.
So, but I think the biggest thing here, and you know, to talk about, obviously these movies, we're going to talk about more specific plot points. So, understandably, I'm going to go ahead and talk about the fact that Alan Turing was gay.
Mm-hmm.
And in England, it was illegal not just like frowned upon or, you know, religious people didn't like it. Like, it was straight up illegal. Like, if you got caught, you would be charged and you would either be thrown in prison or you would, you know, have
subjected
like
hormone.
Yeah. With a hormone castration, I guess. Things like that. So, pretty inhumane ways to handle something that is not really controllable.
Right.
So, with that, we have a really compelling story about World War II, and we have a really sad story socially. So, it's directed by a guy that I looked up, and I didn't actually notice any much of the rest of the stuff that he's done, but it was adapted from Alan Turing, The Enigma, the book. It does have like Benedict Cumberbatch in it, Keira Knightley. I always like to say, Mark Strong, even though he's a side character, everyone loves Mark Strong. He just shows up and he's awesome and everything.
Looks good in the military suit.
Yeah. And then, you know, a host of other Game of Thrones / Downton Abbey characters, much like every movie does these days. So, so it's, you know, it's got a good cast. It was done fairly well. It had lots of Oscar notoriety and it had lots of implications. So, Laura, you said this was your favorite movie of 2014, at least on your list, but then we went and watched it again last night, and you would say that it's not number one anymore, but it's still pretty high to you?
Mm-hmm.
Like, as far as like how much you still enjoyed or how much it made an impact on you?
Well, when I was in the theater, so I did that list pretty soon after we watched it, and when we were in the theater, by the end of the movie, I was crying, and I was like still crying when I left the theater. I was really moved pretty much by that last scene, and I still am really moved by that last scene because it says a lot about being valued and somebody speaking worth over you and being seen and known and appreciated for who you are and who you've been made to be. And I think it's really powerful, and I think that Keira Knightley pretty much knocks it out of the park. So that scene was really meaningful to me. But when we watched it last night, I realized I think it's a really solid story. I'm never bored. I think it's got really great dramatic beats, but it's also pretty funny. It's very well acted. And I like war history, particularly World War II. So that piece appealed to me. I love that era, the music and the clothes and everything. So I think it just kind of hit on a lot of things for me altogether. It feels like a couple of different genres all together.
Mm-hmm.
There's like the spy thriller war history kind of thing. So anyway, there are a lot of reasons why I like it, but I think so I was comparing it to my second favorite movie on my list, which was Calvary. And in terms of like big sweeping, well developed themes, I don't really think that's true about The Imitation Game so much. I think there are several things going on, and I think the piece that I'm most interested in this film thematically is the piece about making judgments about each other, and how do you decide, how can you pass judgment on someone and say you are this thing or you are this thing, or your life is worth this, or, you know, whatever. And I think there's a lot in that, a lot to be said about that. I hope that we'll unpack. But that's not necessarily happening in every scene of the movie. Like, not everything in the movie is building to that particular thing. So I feel like it's a little bit diluted, maybe.
But you still really like the movie.
Yeah, I really like it. And I think it's pretty solid. I don't think I'm going to have a come on moment. I can't think of anything I disliked about it.
Okay. So, Alan, you actually were excited to see this before it came out, and then you saw it, and then you had to rewatch it again because, like I said, it's been a while since it's actually come out. One, how much have you enjoyed it? We already talked about, like, you're not really super critical about stuff, so you weren't really looking at, like, this or that, but, like, coming away with an emotional response or a thematic response, and how much did that impact you, also, or number two, kind of being distanced from it and watching it again, did that reaction change? And you watching it a second time?
Yeah, so like Laura, a very moving movie for me experientially, and the last scene also very powerful. Second time I watched it, it's one of those movies where I probably wouldn't watch it again. Mm-hmm. You know, there are some movies like that that are so good once, and that's all you ever need because of the experience. Mm-hmm. The second time around, the experience, I really felt more true sorrow for his mm-hmm. plight in life and how he was treated at the end of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the first time, you're feeling that, plus you're seeing this man as a instrumental, significant figure in human history
mm-hmm.
for what he accomplished. Plus the enduring legacy of computer science, all the artificial intelligence movies that are
mm-hmm.
out. So all of that, plus mm-hmm. the war history story, was a pretty powerful experience. Second time around, I was like, well, it's still a great story historically, but the experience for me wasn't the same. It was more of a just a real sorrow for how this person was treated.
Mm-hmm. Well, oddly enough, one of the reasons that I really wanted to see it was because I had heard and read about who he was, mm-hmm. and had a cursory glance of kind of what he did, and I really thought most of the movie was going to be about that. I did not realize it was going to be so focused on, or as focused as it was, on his kind of personal life mm-hmm. and the personal struggles that he had to go through, and the kind of personal persecution mm-hmm. that he had to endure, either early in life or late in life,
right.
especially. And so I feel like I almost got two movies in one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it was enough to keep me interested. It was kind of tough, kind of going between some of the three different timelines.
Yeah,
you know, his past, kind of like the present, and then his not so long ago past
mm-hmm.
During the war. And I kind of wish there would have been a lot more time during the war and shown. We could have been shown a lot more of those decisions that they had to make mm-hmm. because even though I think this whole concept of the imitation game or the Turing test
mm-hmm.
kind of being shown through the movie by people having to pretend that they're things that they're not, especially mm-hmm. Alan Turing himself
yeah.
having to pretend this or pretend that at different stages in his life.
Yeah.
And then, you know, all that being top secret, not being able to tell anybody, and then having to be judged for it and really never understanding who he it was.
Right.
I think that was a great overall theme, but I was actually just kind of really fascinated with this concept of them playing God. And,
yeah.
And then, like, having to decide who dies, who doesn't, you know, and
that was almost a third movie
yeah.
in itself.
And so, yeah, one of my only things is, like, I mean, the movie was long enough as it was. I didn't really need to see another 2 hours of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
But this is I felt like a lot of movies that we reviewed that came out towards the end of last year that were, well, actually, the end of last year, towards the beginning of this year, I think we've commented on the show that lots of these, especially with the advances that they're making in, like, storytelling and television,
mm-hmm.
I would have much rather seen, like, a BBC series of, like, a 6-episode Alan yeah. Turing series.
Right.
And kind of seen all these things developed a little bit. And that's I think that's why a lot of people are turning away from, movies in general as, like, giving them lots of credibility, because, like I said, you have in TV, you kind of have to catch on if you're not going to do a miniseries.
Right.
But if you catch on, you have the time to tell not only the story that you intended to tell, but then all the stories that you never thought you would get to tell.
Exactly.
So I feel like this definitely could have been great because of all the underlying themes, the interwoven kind of plots. It could have, like I said, it could have been better on TV, but for what it did, for what it tried to cover, and for the fact that it, I think, was very successful, obviously, in eliciting, like, an emotional response mm-hmm. to either the horribleness of war. I feel like it's a better word than horribleness. The atrocity of war. There you go.
I got a PhD in horribleness.
Yeah. That, you know, the atrocity of war. There's, you know, there's an emotional response to that. There's an emotional response to people who just are like societally like it's almost like a like an autism that he has, like
idiot savant.
Yeah. You know, like you're just working on a higher level, so you don't have time to.
Yeah.
And they addressed it in the movie. You know, it's like everyone.
Socially.
Yeah. When if people were talking to each other, talking in code, and I can't break the code. It was really cool. That was a great scene. But then the piece with kind of the gay social commentary, the women social commentary that we get with Keira Knightley's character, which I think actually was understated compared, you know, because obviously the movie's about Alan Turing. I feel like I'm just trailing off now. You know, there's because there's so much there. So like, we're all emotionally involved.
Yeah, I feel like that was kind of a similar, that was made a similar issue, or that the, anyway, there were points of connection there because he and Joan had a similar experience in society. That they were judged before they had a chance to prove themselves.
Yeah.
And so they understood like where that was coming from.
Right.
But yeah, I felt like that wasn't necessarily two issues. So I didn't feel like I got cheated from her story necessarily.
Yeah. Well, okay, so everyone has already kind of mentioned that one of the most powerful scenes was this final scene of giving someone worth. Why was this final scene impactful to you, Laura? Like, what do you mean by giving him worth? Like, what? Expound upon that.
Because he had so much hardship in his life and sorrow and isolation. And it would be very easy for him, because I feel like I've had this experience myself in life, it would be very easy to say, why did all this happen to me? It shouldn't have been this way. It should have been another way. And to be unable to see the reason, the purpose out of all of that. Mm-hmm. And so I felt like it was meaningful to me to hear Joan say to him, in a pretty stern way, you saved all these people and places. All of this wouldn't exist if it weren't for you, and you wish that you were different. I don't. Mm-hmm. I don't wish that you had a different life. So that gives a lot of it just gives a lot of value to pain and suffering that it's not for nothing. I think that's probably why it hit me so hard.
Yeah, his desire to fit in, to be normal, basically being chastised.
That the world needed him to not be normal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you would kind of jump on that for the same reason?
Yeah, I also think that it's profound that the woman who loved him, and her love was unrequited, certainly, because he wouldn't love her to the degree with which she loved him, but he loved her. That here she is, the one who validates his existence. You know, that was deeply profound. Also, when you flash through the scenes of being bullied and tortured as a kid for being different, and at the end of his life, undergoing another form of torture, basically. And yet she, I think, renews and validates his identity and his purposefulness.
Yeah.
That's just beautiful for me.
Well, I mean, and it says a lot and probably speaks also to when people criticize like Christianity, one of the big ones is, you know, like, why does God allow pain and suffering? And it's not a question that I feel equipped to answer. And I feel like very few people are probably very equipped to answer it. But when you look at the things that people, or how resilient people can be, and you look at pain and suffering, a lot of times, especially through hindsight, where you're brought to, who you're able to help, and the perspective on life that you get from some of those things, mm-hmm. you would never get if everything was easy.
Yeah, there's, so you see in 2 Corinthians, or Paul's in essence saying, because you have experienced suffering and pain, you're then able to extend care and comfort to those who have. So that doesn't help eliminate the wonder in our hearts, why
yeah,
suffering?
The question, yeah,
yeah mm-hmm. but it certainly helps us see it in perspective. You know, that what's happened to me, albeit awful or tragic or horrible, I'm able then to use that experience to help others.
And I think it's important to distinguish between what I hear some people say and what I think we're trying to say here, which would be lots of people use almost like a guilt-based deterrent. Like, you think your life was so bad, someone's always had it worse, so stop complaining. It's not a stop complaining and...
Your pain isn't valid. It's actually validating it.
Yeah. It's not invalidating telling yourself you just need to get over it, pull yourself up, and move on. It's saying your pain is very valid,
mm-hmm.
and since it's valid, look what can come from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's a pretty big distinguisher.
It's interesting. As I think about that scene, I think the reason why it felt real to me was because she was implying, I felt like she was implying something made you this way. Like, there is a bigger picture. There's a divine,
mm-hmm.
I mean, neither of them said divine.
Yeah.
But, you know, fate, let's say. Fate made you this way for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I guess I gave mental credence to that moment. But if you're just kind of telling somebody that without that piece, that's not strong enough to help you overcome adversity.
Yeah. And again, back to her character, knowing the story, the one who as not as much as him, but certainly would have wanted him to be different,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
to have the love relationship that she so
mm-hmm.
desired, to see I sacrifice that for the greater purpose, which was, in fact, your difference is what was used to save many people's lives.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was actually interesting, because I was especially watching it the second time. I was kind of conflicted during the one scene where Turing is trying to get Joan to leave, basically.
Mm-hmm.
He's being loving, but doing it in that, like, if you just were direct with her, you might actually have better success,
mm-hmm.
but doesn't know how to read the situation. And so he's basically telling her that he doesn't care about her and that she needs to leave. And so he tells her that, I'm a homosexual. And she's like, okay, whatever.
Right.
And he's like, no, not, or men, not women. And she's like, don't care.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
But in that, the reason I'm conflicted is because, like, on one side, I see the beauty of this love that you kind of are mm-hmm. mentioning, like this unrequited love. And that's as one of the articles that we'll link in the show notes pointed out, that was kind of like almost like this feint of this love that we hope exists,
mm-hmm.
this love that's going to love us
regardless. Yeah.
And
at sacrifice to itself.
Yeah. At great sacrifice to itself. Being like, it's okay if I don't get this in return. We'll make the best of it, and this is going to be great because I love you anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But then there was the underlying messages of what marriage is, and almost like a critique of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh man, I can't tell if they're just taking jabs at marriage in general. because she says that, it's going to be better than, I have it written down somewhere, sounds like a better marriage than most.
Right.
You know, talking about them basically not being good husbands and wives to each other, but they'll both get to work, it'll be a good arrangement,
yeah.
and they both know each other, and they care about each other more than most people do.
Yeah.
And
there was a reviewer I looked at that said, he was talking about how even the acknowledgement of the sexual dimension to a relationship isn't the end-all, be-all.
Mm-hmm.
you know, that was, there's something greater about love than just the sexual dynamic. And she was saying, okay, if we don't have that in our relationship, we still can have a great marriage, mm-hmm. a relationship together, because we love each other's mind. We value each other as humans. Mm-hmm. I thought that was really a great moment in her response to him.
Yeah, it was, like I said, I really liked the fact that they were not necessarily redefining love, but they were showing love in a way that we typically don't see in movies, because a lot of the times, and this is something that I've griped to Laura unending about, I hate lazy writing, mm-hmm. and one of the most lazy things that I can think of is, okay, we need to tell, or we need to show the audience, because we're showing, not telling, we need to show the audience that, you know, guy A really loves gal A. Mm-hmm. So how can we make sure that the audience knows they don't just like each other, like they love each other?
Yeah.
Okay, well, they're just going to have sex with each other, because that's how you know they love each other.
Right.
And I'm like, it just doesn't work for me. Like, you know, when something happens later in the film, and in that kind of film, to one person or the other, and you're supposed to be really emotionally invested in their relationship because they love each other. I usually don't feel it. I'm like, well, they just had sex.
Right.
You know, they didn't. Did they really love each other? They're like, but we showed you they had sex, though. And I'm like, didn't work for me.
Yeah. Love is much more.
And so, yeah. And so this concept that is portrayed in this, especially this, the first conversation where, you know, where he's telling her to go away, that was really refreshing. And then seeing at the end her, even though she is married to someone else at the end of the movie, come in and speak affirmation to him, mm-hmm. that was also
powerful,
encouraging.
Very powerful.
But with that said, so I kind of want to talk about something that I want to be careful how I talk about it, because it would be, or it's fairly controversial. And like Laura mentioned earlier in the show, it's something that people are talking a lot about now. Because mm-hmm. at least at the time of this recording, there, you know, are laws going in place mm-hmm. about, you know, what religious people, not just Christians, what religious people can or can't do with their business, what rights gay people have, mm-hmm. what rights gay people don't have, what rights non-gay people have in relation to gay, you know, there's a whole lot of conversations going on right now. And one of the things that, one of the ideas out there is that at one point, homosexuality was thought of in a pretty straightforward way. It's all about sex. It's just a way to get sexual gratification. Mm-hmm. And that narrative has changed, especially over the past few years, as this topic has come to the forefront of social discussion. Mm-hmm. And that has shifted from, it's not about sex, it's about love.
Right.
And I can't tell in this movie if they... Well, to me, there's two different messages of what being gay is. And one is there's a deep love, but the other side of it says, but I'm still fine with it just being sex. Because ultimately, the reason Turing is caught is because he's soliciting sex, not from people he loves, but basically from male prostitutes.
Right. I don't think that's fair, though, because it was illegal, so it had to be secretive. And I think living in the way he probably would want to with a partner would have been really suspicious. And also,
I feel like it would have been less suspicious.
And also, I feel like you said that he was fine with that kind of lifestyle, and I don't think that he was fine with having
tortured.
He was doing that to fill in a need he felt he had, but I mean, not because that's how he wanted to live out his life or his attraction. I actually really appreciated how this film has the conversation about, it's actually about identity.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't actually address it in terms of relationships between two gay men or between a man and a woman. It doesn't really talk about it that it doesn't talk about it like that at all. It talks about it more like, this is a part of who I am, and I can't fully express who I am to people around me. I can't be honest about who I am, and so I have to hide myself. I'm being judged by my surface. Anyway, I appreciated it because I felt like it got down to something that I think that most people can agree with, which is that here's my life story. Can you say that I am one thing based on what I've done or not done?
Mm-hmm. Which is what he does.
Can you slap a label on me and say that I am this? Am I just gay? Am I a war hero? You know, so I think that it actually came to a pretty equalizing place that was worth saying, because there are a lot of people out there, I think, that do what he's saying. They say, well, you're this thing I don't understand, and so you're worthless, or you're less worth, you have less worth than I do,
mm-hmm.
because I'm the norm or whatever. So I like the way it handled the discussion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for me, I think the obviously an amazing intellect. I mean, his mind, mm-hmm. you know, phenomenal. The theme that kept running through that discourse for me was the inherent value of humanity,
mm-hmm.
and how even a lifestyle that is certainly even controversial still, but then was verboten, it was forbidden, that the treatment of him, the ill treatment of him, was, I think, an aggression against humanity.
Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that he's worthy. In so many respects, he was this hero, and yet he's treated so poorly by a culture that he saved. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know what I mean? That's what I found.
Just like Jesus.
Yeah, exactly. Yes.
Actually, what you just said about, what was the phrase you used? The value of humanity? Is that what you said? Did you use the word value?
Inherent dignity and value of humanity.
That actually is a pervasive theme, because if you think, like, if you put it on a grander scale, I mean, we have people judging each other in this movie, like, in general,
mm-hmm.
and making decisions about lives, their own and other people's. And it's interesting to me, I would need to, like, flesh it out by verbally processing it, but the idea that they were making a judgment on who got to live and who got to die. So, anyway.
Well,
talk about that connection.
Another scene that ties into this for me was early on in the movie when he had to fire the two guys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he's sitting there. It's just this awkward scene. And, you know, who gives him the power to do this? Well, Winston Churchill does, you know. And so the guys are obviously mad that he fired him. But he's looking at them almost as if, I'm judging your performance ability. But the bigger picture for me is, this is a life and death project.
Mm-hmm.
This is about the survival of the British people and maybe even, you know, the world. And so even though I'm judging you for your performance, it's not personal. You know, mm-hmm. I found that really ironic that mm-hmm. he was actually judged
mm-hmm.
at a different level later on.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, and that was the very thing that people were repulsed by in his personality was the very thing that kind of, well, needs a very strong word, because maybe there's a way that could have been done in a less calculated way. But they needed to be able to have someone who could say, this is the end goal. You know, these are the people that need to be on the boat if we're going to get there.
Yeah.
And y'all are weighing us down.
Right.
You know, we've got extra anchors on board right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's not the polite thing to do.
Right.
But it, you know, it's goal oriented. You know?
Strategic.
Yeah.
Yeah, it actually makes the most sense for the context. But we get so, all that gets so convoluted with personal feeling and grudges. Connection. And,
yeah. So he was busy not talking in code when everyone else was trying to, mm-hmm. you know,
exactly.
make it all nice.
Right.
But see, it's that cold-heartedness that also led to the thing that I was mentioning before, where you have to realize that I know we want to save, one guy's brother on the ship, but if we do,
we cost other people's lives.
You know, how many more millions of people are going to die?
Yeah.
Because we kind of tip our hand. And that, it's really hard, especially in, like, war, because war is atrocious.
Yeah.
To stop and take the human element out of it.
Right.
So I think it's a great question that, or it adds a lot of depth to that question that Laura kind of mentioned, that he basically asked the detective at the end. Well, you know, when he says, like, am I a machine? Am I human? Am I a war hero? Or am I a criminal? Right. You know, like,
Who am I really? He
was all those things. He's not just putting machine in there for fun or another option. Like, he basically is accused of being a machine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it actually aids him in many ways.
Yeah.
To accomplish the goal that he accomplished.
Yeah.
But I would say, at the end of the day, he's not a machine.
No.
Mm-hmm.
And because he is a human being, quirky as he is, he still needs community. Mm-hmm. Like, he needs people.
Yeah.
And I think the more and more he realizes that, he does strike a balance in as messed up of situation and life that he had. Which is why I think, you know, he values Joan's character, or Joan as a human being, so much, and is willing to go, like, to her house and, you know, fight for her.
Or he buys the lunches to try to win his colleagues over.
Yeah, you know? Like, once he realizes that he needs it, and it is actually, you know, something that, once it's something he realizes he needs, he does it, obviously, poorly and very awkwardly, but he is trying, and I think... The cool thing to see, at least the way it plays out, you know, I don't obviously know how it plays out in real life, because the real life bonding probably wasn't as quirky and humorous, as the movie plays it out to be. But just seeing their response, being like, look, we understand that touring is way out in right field. Like, he's so far out in right field, he's actually probably sitting in the parking lot, like, on the other side of the fence.
Right.
You know, he's not even on the field.
Yeah.
And so the fact that he does even one thing, they realize that's, like...
big deal.
You know, that's... it's not... like, he's not going to be perfect. He's just got to be trying.
Yeah.
And I think that's... I mean, that says a lot about the people that he's working with, and... I don't know. It was nice to see.
Is it too, like, lofty to say...
yes.
Okay.
No, I'm speaking.
that there is, like, an enigma that this film is focused on. There's, like, an unbreakable code that this movie is trying to break. And I'm trying to figure out what that is. The closest thing I can get to right now is, what does it mean to be human? Because I think there are a lot of characters in this film that are, we would like to say that's a good guy or that's a bad guy, but they keep switching roles. They keep being, they're enigmas. You can't pinpoint them, because who's the Soviet spy guy? What's his name?
His name is John.
It's not Branson from Downton Abbey. It is Branson from Downton Abbey.
It's John.
Cane Cross. Yeah, he's actually a pretty nice guy. I mean, he sticks up for Turing. He does his part. He legitimately is trying to help in his view, but he's also a spy that's lying to everybody, you know. Joan, like, I think we've already talked about, she is loving and sacrificial, but also in that conversation with Alan, she is kind of like, I don't really care what you want. Right. You're a means to an end. At the end of the day, you're a means to an end. So I need you, and you don't have a say in this anymore. So, yeah, people keep being, and even him, like, people wanted to be able to categorize him as this inhuman computer, walking computer, but he actually had really tender moments where he really was a friend. So,
well, and his, Mike, you probably had to take these too, but I took computer science, and then I had to take a lot of math in my degree. So algorithms are his forte, and how the enigma of the German code was actually broken very easily by a complex algorithm. Mm-hmm. But the human complexity is unfathomable at one level. So, it's just, even the title of the movie, The Imitation Game, borrowing off of really his work of artificial intelligence, not this scenario, was... Mm-hmm. I saw that as part of the... Mm-hmm. What was really the code? It's the human... I mean, there's the human side of our complexity, and...
And we, like, and having, like, and... That, okay, so the part where he says, they talk about how many possibilities they are, and he breaks that down and says it would take, like, this many people for, like, 20 trillion, million years or something like that. Humans cannot do it. It's impossible. There's something bigger, much greater than us, that is necessary to break that code. And, yeah, and, like, just hearing you talk about that whole, that the human aspect of it is the most complex part. That was the thing that they couldn't figure out until it clicked with that, whatever, that girl in the bar or in the, you know, where she was saying.
Yeah, Joan's friend.
Yeah, Joan's friend, where she was talking about her German counterpart and, you know, that whole human element where we make really simple mistakes that wasn't not really accounted for. And then when they started accounting for the human element, they got the other part. So anyway, but yeah, they needed something bigger. That seems like a pretty big idea. They need something more than themselves to be able to figure it out.
Well, I really like something that I noticed the second time through is I think something that you guys are kind of either hitting on and moving on from quickly, or you might not realize that you're saying it, but...
That's because we're very complex.
You're very complex.
You just can't break this enigma, Mikey. It's okay.
It's that... So the imitation game, like, it doesn't just apply to Turing. Almost every character, I would say every character, but I'd have to actually stop and go through almost every character. But basically every character that has any realistic, or any, not realistic, but any formidable amount of screen time.
Mm-hmm. Right, any development.
Has multiple...
Facets.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they're all playing multiple parts.
Right.
And I think that's actually one of the things that I really liked about it the second time I watched it. Mm-hmm. Because to me, that says a lot about the actual writing itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it says someone went in the forethought and said, this is our theme. Everyone's going to be playing a game, or everyone's going to be having to decide what world they're really in.
Right.
And we're going to make every character that, which is what... in the screenplay me and Mark are writing, is like one of the things we're trying to really hard to do. We're like, the only stereotypes are this one thing. Everyone else is not a stereotype. Mm. And so in this particular case, you have the, you know, Turing, who's wearing he's wearing lots of different hats.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he's wearing so many that he doesn't even know what world he belongs in. And Joan is like a meek and husband needy woman. Not by her own, you know, wishes, but...
Playing a role to get what she wants.
Playing a role, but she is also a brilliant, obviously...
5 minutes puzzle and 34
solver,
seconds.
Yeah, puzzle solver and mathematician herself. Mm-hmm. And the guy who was the national chess champion twice was the playboy.
Yeah.
You know, like, how many times is the chess champion... the playboy.
Yeah.
You know, John was the mathematician, but also the spy. You know,
everybody was somebody else.
Everyone was someone else. Mm-hmm. I mean, because I even love the fact that Commander Dennison was the guy who wanted to win the war more than anyone and was doing the most to prevent the war from being won.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, he's working against himself. And so the opposite is true with Stuart... the MI6 guy, Mark Strong's character.
Yeah.
You know,
Mark Strong.
Yeah, just Mark Strong. Just call him Mark Strong. He's always been.
He's always Mark Strong.
Yeah, in the beginning was Mark Strong. He does, you know, he is part of the shadiest piece of government intelligence and ends up being the most helpful, you know, like almost going. Doing the opposite of what you would imagine, you know, instead of hindering or sabotaging right. or whatever, trying to get the leg up. He's like, I invite you into what's going on.
Right.
And then, you know, we'll be the most helpful thing. So, like, everyone's got, you know, more...
Right, so what's the big idea? What are you getting at with all these examples?
Yeah, I just wanted to break down, like, every single one because it was all so interesting.
Yeah.
So, like I said, so that's the thing. The theme is not just a touring. The theme is, I think, really well woven through this picture.
Mm-hmm.
This moving picture.
Mm-hmm. No, that is interesting because of stereotypes in general. It would be easy to say that this movie is an exploration of a gay man and how he's ostracized from right. society for what he is. And that he's the weird one and we have to figure out, like, how does he fit? But that does say something, to say that everybody can be subjected to mm-hmm. that test. Are you man or machine? Mm-hmm. What are you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I agree. I didn't want this to go too terribly long, so I wanted to kind of start moving in to our wrap-up. And we do that by starting with kind of critiquing a little bit.
Okay.
So, Laura, you said you might not have any kind of come-on moments or moments that you wish, like, were a little different, but we've been talking for a while now. Anything kind of come up? Anything that you wish was a little bit different?
I actually really liked the flashbacks to him as a kid. Mm-hmm. I thought all of those were placed really well. And I like where the most modern day storyline with a detective, I like where that went in terms mm-hmm. of putting him in a room with a detective when he was... I mean, that was actually the larger framework for the whole story. But there were definitely some scenes that felt... If there was anything that was yawn-worthy, it was watching that detective walk around from desk yeah. to desk. So I don't know if it could have been done differently, but that was maybe the part that didn't catch my attention the most. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I got for you.
That's all you got? All you got.
Really, it is. I'm right. sorry.
So, Alan, you've seen it twice now?
Anything yeah. So the thing that bothered me is I would have... You know, we're talking about this amazing machine
mm-hmm.
and what it accomplished, and there was very little
mm-hmm.
detail yeah. about it. Like,
it's got the knobbies with the clips.
Right, they just turns. You know, like, what I would, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe I'm a
it spins well
nerd, but I would have loved to understand or had in the story the explanation of that. Like, there was mm-hmm. something really... missing that they didn't talk about the power of the machine and what it really what made it do what it did. I mean, that's brilliant.
Yeah, which is weird because
they didn't even have to make it up. It was real.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, yeah, which is the weird part because it would have probably been like they tried to show it, but I don't think they fully showed it.
Right.
And so sometimes you kind of need to tell a little bit. It's why, like, in, you know, in films, you have the person, we talked about this before on different movies, you have the person who shows up and says, I'm the new guy. Can someone explain to me who right. all these people are right. and what we're doing?
Right.
You know? And so...
Like, if it's Jupiter Ascending, it's like the it's main Jupiter character.
Yeah.
So, like, in this case, it would not have been very hard for, you know, when they started becoming, I guess, more compatriots and stuff, yeah. they're like... Alan, I don't understand. How does this thing work anyway?
Right. Well, it's the principle of algorithm.
It's quite simple. I don't have time to explain it because I'm too busy being smart. And they're like, and then, you know, Keira Knightley, like, pokes him in the shoulder. He's like, oh, I would love to explain it. And then we get the explanation. You know?
Right.
And it's I wanted that.
And I wanted it more in the second one. In the first one, the movie's moving with the character details and the arc of that. So you maybe, well, I experienced the emotion of the story overwhelm the mm-hmm. scientific reality, the technology aspect to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Quite impressive.
Yeah. I mean,
out of
fundamentally.
Nothing. Yeah. He's just like, I got an idea.
Staggering what he did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Given the state of technology in his time.
And the, like, I wish I could put this in perspective. But I know that I fully don't understand the perspective of it. The fact that we get a new iPhone like every year and a half.
We take for granted.
But this dude built a computer like in a year,
mm-hmm.
like from nothing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not he just made the camera better.
Well, he took a concept mentally
mm-hmm.
and put it. He's mm-hmm. more of a mathematician than he was an engineer.
Mm-hmm.
It was based on another. It was based on a theory or a project that somebody had done before,
mm-hmm.
but. But yeah, he took it to way a whole other place.
Yeah.
Other level.
So that was my come on.
Tell
your goodness.
Tell
me a little bit more about that chick button, you know.
Listener, yeah, because when they walk in there and they finally get the missing piece, the human element that mm-hmm. kind of helps the machine do, and he's like, tell me what the words are, and he like moves the pieces. We're like, why are we moving these pieces mm-hmm. around? How did this help? Yeah. How close were we all along? You know. How many words do we need to get before this would have, you know?
Yeah.
No. Anyway.
Yeah, that's right. That would have been cool.
So
it didn't actually.
My father was retired as an information technology department head.
Mm-hmm.
He had 30, 40 employees working for him when he retired. But prior to that, that department wasn't called information technology; it was called data processing.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was little, he would take me up to the company, and we had to go into this room that was elevated
mm-hmm.
and air-conditioned.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's just this big machine with a turning tape cassette, and it's throwing out all these punch cards. You know, so that's my experience growing mm-hmm. up as a kid. My dad's a computer guy.
Mm-hmm.
So for this, I was left a little hanging with this movie, like, oh, come, just a little, you know. Now I want to go watch the stinking History Channel or whatever to find out just amazing creation he made.
But that can be good, too, because I like watching something and going, you know, especially when it says based on a true story, because you know, the joke is, like,
loosely based.
You know, like, they're like, if you want to make something that was in history, always say it's based on a true story, even if it's not based on a true story. So it's hard to tell what's real and what's not.
Yeah.
And actually, because of this movie, because of kind of what I would say was a frustration with it of not getting some of those pieces, because I love the history major. I mean, like, mm-hmm. whatever. I wanted some of that, but now I'm like, I kind of want to go read this book.
Right.
I want to see like what it says. I want to know more about him. More about this machine, more about like the specific situations, like I said, we didn't get of them. Like, what decisions did they make?
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, what did it affect? Like,
yeah.
You know, what battles did they do? You know, just seeing like those specific instances in history where we've watched, you know, History Channel special after History Channel special of, you know, some large battle like in the Ardennes or something.
Well,
like
wasn't there a movie a few years ago called Enigma where they get the machine? So it's a submarine movie where they actually steal one of those processing machines, and that's prior to this event.
Okay, I just look it up right now.
Is that right?
Looks like it. Kate Winslet,
mm-hmm.
with her 1940s hair.
Yep.
Looks like a submarine. Let's see. A young genius frantically races against time to crack an enemy code and solve the mystery surrounding the woman he loves. Yeah.
Mm.
Let's see how it went off the rails like right at the end.
Right.
Yeah.
But so that was in 2001. Yeah. That was in 2001. That was before, I believe, it was made unclassified or declassified. Because I'd have to relook and see when it was declassified. Probably should have written things down like that. I mean, totally did, editing this later. But
I'd like to think that the edited version will have, like, an obvious overlay of Mikey being like, I don't know when that was published in.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it became declassified 10 years ago. But yeah, so I would say, yeah, that was probably some of my... frustration is probably a strong word for it, but you know, the thing that could have done without. Other than that, like I said, it was basically how the story was told, which is kind of a cop out, come on, kind of thing. Because again, I thought it did well with what it needed to do in the time frame it did. Would have loved to have been expanded or them to kind of narrow their focus a little bit.
Yeah.
But if they'd done that, I think they would have lost out on one of those facets.
Yeah, because in the end, all that was necessary context.
It was all part of the story.
So. That's a backhanded insult. You know, it's actually a couple. Laura. So
double negative.
So you've already obviously talked about things that you really like, some scenes that you really like, but what was really your favorite moment?
That last scene for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the way it was written was so good. Where she was like, "I bought a ticket from a man who would be dead if it wasn't for you." She was like, "I rode a train through a town that would have been leveled if it wasn't for you." Mm-hmm. I mean, just like putting it in terms, in undeniable the terms, impact. What his impact was. So that scene for sure, and then actually the scene where, they come to turn off his machine, and he is. It's probably one of the first, if I remember correctly, it's probably one of the first truly honestly raw
where
emotional.
Where he breaks down, cries,
moments where he shows that he's human, and his like compatriots really have no reason to stand up for him at all, but they all come to his aid. That was, I think that. Was meaningful to me, having seen the way that people turned on him as a kid, and now the reverse was happening. And his moment of stress, people are saying, people are showing faith, like true faith, which means they have no idea what the outcome is going to be. They're just hoping that it's going to be positive, and their faith will be rewarded. Right. So I thought, in general, Cumberbatch had me the whole time. Believing that he was who he said he was. So I thought that he was really great, and that Keira Knightley was pretty great.
I was really disappointed with some of the critics. I mean, I'm easily disappointed with critics. I'm sorry.
Yeah,
critics.
Saying that he was just Sherlock. It was. Yeah. I felt like it was much more nuanced.
Yeah,
than
I never felt that he was Sherlock for a second. No.
Yeah. No.
I mean, that's
I mean,
like
just
saying
because they're both smarty pants doesn't mean that they.
Yeah.
That wasn't his fault that they share characteristics.
That's like saying that there's no nuance to all the roles that The Rock takes. Like, he's just some strong guy.
Or
you know?
Tom Cruise's laugh when he does this, you know. I mean, yeah, he's always going to be Tom Cruise in every movie. So. Okay, so I referenced this earlier. The significance. Again, people speaking into his identity throughout the movie. The part where they're walking through the hallway of this probably old school, wherever he went, and the older student who I think was probably his first love, so to speak, was really building him. And Laura, it's not registering.
The phrase.
It comes out several times.
Okay, he says, it is...
Can we just read it?
Oh, you got it?
Of course I got it.
Oh,
fine.
Of course you do.
Sometimes it is the people who no one imagines anything of who do the things that no one can imagine.
That's the scene I love. Just that foreshadowing of the purpose of his life, speaking into the identity, the hopefulness to a young child who obviously knows, I don't fit in. I'm always going to be the odd duck who's, you know, probably... plays into his quest to have a significant role in human history and the drive to which he did it. That part just, you know, I didn't know much about Turing before I watched the movie. I knew about the machine, but it was that at that moment that I became very interested in the real person, Alan Turing. Like, wow, what did he, who was he really?
Yeah.
So that was a big scene for me. Although, again, the end was just a man. If you didn't cry at the end, you don't have a
then
heart.
You're not a machine.
Human. You are a machine.
You don't even need to take the test. That is the Turing test.
Yeah, that's the Turing test. Did you cry at the end?
Did you cry?
But so then it would be like the Terminator 2 test when he's like, "I now know why you cry."
Right.
And then he goes down to the molten.
Yeah. Sacrifice. Love.
Yeah.
Exactly the same. All right, Mikey.
So I wanted to have a different favorite part than you guys. And I think I kind of do, because, I mean, like, I appreciated those emotional scenes, but as someone who is a machine myself, I mean, whoops, did I say that? No, I didn't. I meant not machine.
Definitely human, yeah.
I really just like the, I really like the entire scene, how it plays out when they, it starts with, there's only about 5 people in the world who know where every single ship in the Atlantic is, mm-hmm. you know, and they're all in this room. And then how it all just keeps playing from there. And, you know, the stakes escalate and escalate in that scene until we, you know, like, Turing's getting punched. And, like, we understand why he gets punched.
Mm-hmm.
And we were like, he probably needed to be punched.
Right.
But at the same time, like, the immediacy of them being like, Andy's right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And having to tell the one guy no.
Yeah.
No matter what, and explain that and explain the stakes and see the big picture.
Mm-hmm. That kid did an amazing job in that scene.
That was a great scene.
You're talking about when he was like, you're killing my brother.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. That kid did an amazing job.
So I just thought that, I feel like that could have been really cheesy, or it could have been over the top,
yeah.
or, you know, too cold, but I thought it struck a good balance, and I don't know. I just thought the scene was really well done, and it like I said, it did remind me of the pieces that I am probably most interested in from the story, mm-hmm. about how they figured all this stuff out.
Mm.
So that was probably my favorite part of the movie. But with that, like I said, we're about to wrap up, but I give you a chance. Any kind of final thoughts? Anything we didn't cover, Laura, that you wanted to mention?
Look at my notes.
Dun, dun. Dun, look at, you should have already looked at your notes. You know what comes next? You're pro.
I guess not.
But you would still obviously recommend this movie. And it's and it's still like in your top 5.
Yeah, I really like it. I
mean, top 5 all time or top 5
this past year? No, from last year.
Okay.
Yeah, not from all time.
Yeah, it's not an all-timer.
But, I like it a lot. I think it has a conversation that needs to be had in a way that's accessible to everybody.
Fair enough. Alan, any final thoughts? Anything we missed?
Something we didn't talk about. You mentioned it briefly at one point, but here's one man whose role saves the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I, as a person of faith, in this movie, I see tremendous themes of redemption, sacrifice, the bigger story.
Mm-hmm.
That I really... this movie for me has the ability to spur a lot of conversations. You've got the social issues of
mm-hmm.
same sex, that sort of thing. You've got the dilemma of sacrificing a few to save the many,
mm-hmm.
sort of morality of that. There are just so many themes, but that one of here's one guy who consistently, doggedly is out to save the world.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Well, it's really interesting because when you start putting a spiritual spin on, like, who Turing was and what he had to do, it's that delicate balance of not, like, you know, not reading more into the movie than is really there, mm-hmm. but that doesn't negate the fact that you can still extrapolate that from the movie.
Sure.
And that's what I'm usually pulling from the movie,
mm-hmm.
and then like there's that one piece where they're talking about like the power to choose who dies and who lives,
mm-hmm.
and he has this line where he's like, "Was I God? No, because God didn't win the war. We did."
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man,
no.
I'm like, man, but you know, maybe I want to ask a question that. I don't really think we have time for, because it definitely would... it's probably something we actually talked about on previous shows, like Fury and things like that. But it's kind of like, what part does God play in war? Because, you know, it's like the criticism that lots of people of non-faiths or people who were not very friendly to religion, I think rightly criticized, you know, like athletes.
Wanted me to win the crown.
One of my favorite shticks from George Carlin back in the day was when he talks about Christian athletes and how they always mention God when they win, but they never talk about Him when they lose.
Yeah,
he's like, they never say the good Lord tripped me up at the line of scrimmage, right? Or, you know,
God caused me to fumble.
God made me fumble. Stuff like that.
You know, actually, I had already been thinking that that line was pretty contradictory with the tone of the final scene, which is that there is something bigger than us
bigger
that directs,
purpose.
You know, who we are for a reason. But I mean, I think that even it makes sense that he would even think in that way, because we find him in this scene saying, why am I this way? Why am I having to endure this? And I think that question, like, where is God in war, is the same question when you say, like, where is God in
suffering,
you know, in any kind of suffering, in making me a way that I, that is not socially acceptable, you know, that I can't understand, no other people can understand. So I think that question is not really something that's answered, maybe, but is pervasive. And I felt like the end of the film actually was pretty optimistic about that, in terms of, like, things happen for a reason.
Yeah, there is a bigger, there's something bigger at work. Yeah.
Well, but let's say, where is God in everything is the question, and let's just not try to answer that at all. That's really for you guys out there in audience land to try to discuss, you know, like, just hit us back later. You know, we'd love to just, you know, Twitter about it, or let's have a Facebook conversation about it. I'm sure it'll be very productive.
Yeah, and civil.
We'll figure that out.
Sure.
Where is God in everything?
Right.
Well, I'll go ahead and start that Facebook conversation later.
Yeah.
Well, but we, like I said, we are to the end of our time, and I'm always very appreciative that anyone would take the time to come and talk about any movie with me, because it is so very fun. So. Because of that, I want to make sure that you guys could continue the conversation, because I knew you wouldn't be here if you didn't want to talk about this movie. So, Laura, if people wanted to follow your work or communicate with you in some way about something, how would they do that?
I guess probably Twitter.
Probably Twitter?
At Laura_Fissle. I don't really tweet as much as I should.
Because people don't tweet at her.
That's right. It's all y'all's fault.
Yeah, get out there and tweet her.
And my website, laurafissle.com.
All right. Alan, how can people follow you?
So Twitter is at KeepAlanWalking.
Which, I mean, it blows up my phone all the time.
Exactly.
Like, you tweet so much.
I mean, life is kind of calming down in many ways for some outside reasons, but I would like to learn to use social media better. So I'm fascinated with it. Like, I see RT. I'm guessing that's retweet. Okay, so there you have it. I'm really impressing people.
Yeah. First rule of Twitter is you don't talk about how to Twitter.
Yeah, no. Okay. First rule of Fight Club is, yeah. That's probably that way. Website, redeemergso.org. I'm a pastor of a church, and those are the two best ways.
Follow what you're doing. And I would say one of the best ways to learn most things is out of necessity. So I really feel like if you're listening to this, it's your responsibility to help Alan and Laura tweet more. And to do that, you should be tweeting them. And if you tweet them, they will respond.
Will tweet you back? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Tweeting.
Don't ask. Just confident. Oh, yeah. Remember, air boldly.
Yeah.
I'm gonna tweet you back. I'm gonna tweeter you. Right. It's gonna be the tweetiest that you've ever
You're
tweeted.
Be Twitterized.
Yeah.
After.
Well, anyway, you can follow me at multiple places at Fizzification on Twitter. You can follow the show at Real World Theo. You usually have updates and things when we have new articles and stuff up.
Like when my next Whoology post is going to come out in a couple weeks.
Yeah, like when Laura claims her next Whoology post will come out in a couple weeks. Then it'll be there on the Twitter. So, but if you'd like to know more about Real World Theology specifically, you can go to our website if you haven't already, realworldtheology.com. That's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. You can connect with us on Facebook. Me and Josh spend a lot of time talking to you guys on Facebook. We really love those conversations. You can subscribe to the podcast on Twitter or, not on Twitter. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or on Stitcher.
What's on your mind?
I know. We've been talking about Twitter. And if you enjoy it, you know, please review the show. We really appreciate you guys' feedback. And, you know, keep those reviews coming. We continue always to have more and more star ratings. And it's just really encouraging to see how many of you guys are listening, how many of you guys are enjoying the show, what you like about it, you know, what we can do better. So, with that, I want to thank Alan.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank Laura.
You're welcome.
You know, for being here. Without you, this show would have been me talking in circles. So, about how awesome I think movies are. So, thank you guys. Thank you, listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
My new favorite thing is to try to interrupt your laugh and be Theo. Just to try to break it up as much as possible.
This podcast is a member of the Crossover Nexus. To find out more or to hear about other podcasts that engage faith and pop culture, please go to www.crossovernexus.com.
Well, and I think the best ones are when they say things that couldn't be rehearsed. Like when Kevin McHale fell down and made a basket.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing, the famous line was, "McHale, from a prone position!" You know, just totally